You're listening to Parallax from Radcliffe Cardiology in association with MakeADent.org. Here is your host, Ankur Kalra, MD.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Parallax. This is episode 111. This is a divine number for me, as I'm sure is for many listeners. If not, look it up. It's sort of a divine number. It's incredible to have on the show with me someone who I consider a dear friend. He is a tour de force, extremely well-published, terrific clinician, super well-trained, a great colleague and friend. I call him Saras. Saras, welcome on the show. Welcome to Parallax. And Saras is here with us. He's going to wrap up ACC 24 for us, a highly action-packed meeting in cardiology. Terrific trials were presented. Terrific science was presented. Some practice-changing science was presented, in my opinion. And we're going to discuss five trials that Saras has picked for us, which he thinks are important in the context of how we manage our patients in cardiovascular medicine. So with that introduction, Saras, thank you so much for doing this for us. This is a divine episode, 111. Welcome on the show.
Hi, Ankur. Thank you for having me. Truly appreciate the opportunity to share some time with you and your listening audience. Thanks for the opportunity. So as you know, I'm an interventional and a critical care cardiologist. So that's my bias. I pick trials that we see relevant to patients we see in our practice, both in the outpatient setting, the cardiac cath lab, or in the cardiac ICU when they're extremely sick. So we will start with the first one. The one that I really want to discuss is called Danger Shock. So Danger Shock, as you know, Ankur, was a study that was many years in the making. This is a trial looking at use of a microaxial percutaneous left ventricular assist device, commonly known as the Impella pump, in patients with STEMI complicated by cardiogenic shock. This has been in the making for nearly slightly over 10 years now. Initially started as a Danish shock trial and then included Germany and became Danger Shock. Eventually included some sites from the United Kingdom. About 355 patients that they screened with STEMI and cardiogenic shock. Cardiogenic shock was largely defined as low blood pressure, hypoperfusion, need for vasopressor support, and low LV function less than 45%. And in these patients, they excluded many things: mechanical complications, severe aortic valve disease, peripheral arterial disease, which would impede the large bore access for the circulatory support. But most importantly, in my opinion, they excluded patients with comatose out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, which has been the Achilles heel of shock trials thus far. So this is a very appropriate exclusion. After that, they randomized patients with STEMI and cardiogenic shock into those with and without the need for Impella assistance. And they performed standard of care techniques for PCI, did culprit vessel PCI only, and then staged their non-culprit disease during the same hospitalization or subsequently soon after as per contemporary practice. In this trial, they randomized the patients, mean arterial lactate was 4.5, so they were quite sick. Mean EF was 25%. 20% were resuscitated. So 20% were resuscitated non-comatose out of hospital arrest. And largely, about 72% were anterior MI, which, as you know, is the sickest subgroup of those presenting with STEMI. And nearly half was stage C cardiogenic shock, a quarter was stage D, and a sixth was stage E. So quite a sick spectrum of the population. They took these patients, and 96% received PCI. Very importantly, nearly 50% of them had an Impella placed pre-PCI, which is a paradigm that many of us who work in the shock space have been asking for or advocating for passionately to improve the ventricular function prior to opening up the artery. I'm going to pause here before I share the results and see what comments or guidance you have for me, and then we'll keep going.
Yeah, no, thanks, Saras. Thanks for putting this into context. I agree with you that this is arguably the most vexing patient population that we care for as interventionalists. And acute myocardial infarction complicated by cardiogenic shock, as you know, and have published, has remained stable, unfortunately, with a mortality of 50% across the spectrum of all the advancements which have been made in primary PCI. So certainly a patient population that merits research and attention. And the microaxial flow pump, or the Impella as it's called in our vernacular, has been in practice for a decade. This trial has been trying to enroll patients for a decade. So, you know, one can understand how hard it is to enroll. And congratulations to the investigators for their perseverance on this. And I, you know, one of the important comments that you made was that in 50% of these patients, it was that the device was placed pre-PCI, which is a paradigm shift. I have a few questions for you, and I think you'd be the perfect person to answer because you're a critical care cardiologist as well as an interventionalist. Saras, when you are suspecting cardiogenic shock based on clinical presentation, index presentation, what makes you clinch that diagnosis other than just cool, clammy extremities and hypertension on clinical presentation? Is it lactate? Is it creatinine? Is it decrease in urine output? And, you know, we're in the throes of STEMI here. So, you know, I understand that time is of essence. And, you know, this assessment needs to be made and the diagnosis needs to be determined before you are going to commit yourself to mechanical circulatory support. So I think it'll be helpful to listen your viewpoint as to how you clinch that diagnosis in an expeditious fashion before you commit to placing this device. And I'm going to bring right heart catheterization here as well, and the use of pulmonary artery pulsatility indexes. That's something that is required for you to clinch that diagnosis before you make the determination.
Yeah, that's a tremendous question, Ankur. That's really the holy grail of what we do in the cath lab, is make thoughtful, quick decisions, hoping that we are thinking about the right things and working on the right aspects while caring for an acutely ill patient. And the odds and stakes are that much more higher in patients with cardiogenic shock. So I'll tell you my approach. This is a conglomeration of all the approaches that I've learned from my teachers and mentors over the years, and kind of best practices that I've picked up in my own practice over the last few years and trying to put it all together. So the few things that we have to be cautious in cardiogenic shock are: time is still of essence, but opening the artery is not the be-all and end-all of our existence in that space. So for all my STEMIs, including those with cardiogenic shock, I strongly resist the urge to go up with a guide catheter. So when I get access on this patient, I give off 10, 15, 20 cc's of blood for labs. Often these patients with STEMIs come to the cath lab, either directly to the lab or from the ED without having blood work drawn. So I give off blood so that we get a full hematological panel, metabolic panel. We get lactate, we get blood gases, et cetera. All that information that's going to come in by the time you're done with your diagnostic shots. After I get access, often radial, rarely femoral, once I'm up there, I like to have as much information at my disposal as I can without causing significant delays. To me, that involves this blood work that you just sent off, involves going up with a universal catheter. For me, it's a Tiger catheter. For others, it could be Jackie or something similar, is to get both coronaries without a guide and use the same catheter, dip into the ventricle and get an EDP. Often, if they've come to the lab, I've had either the fellow or myself put a probe on the patient and looked to get a basic assessment of the LV function, mitral regurgitation, and if there is any aortic stenosis that will fight you. So once you have all this information, so at this point, you have a hemodynamic appreciation of their macrovascular hemodynamics with blood pressure, heart rates, etc. You have an understanding of the respiratory function, look at their work of breathing, you've looked at their respiratory rate, saturations. Hopefully by now your ISTAT blood gas is back. Maybe some renal function is back. Lactate is definitely back on the oximetry. And then you already have a central macrovascular assessment of the hemodynamics with an EDP. And you have an assessment of the EF. If there's any doubt, I will go with a pigtail and inject an LV gram. That's one of the last remaining indications to get an LV gram if I don't have an echo in a patient with STEMI. So all this takes maybe 5, 8, maybe 10 minutes, but it gives you all the information you need to make a thoughtful decision. And for me, I have a very, I do not do a right heart cath at this point because it's a significant investment of vascular access and threading a catheter through the various chambers, which takes time, even more so if you're femoral, slightly lesser if you're brachial or IJ. But regardless, it takes, at that point, you have enough information to make a thoughtful decision. And if, for me, a rule of thumb has been, if the LVEDP is greater than the LVEF, this patient is tethering or threatening to decompensate. It's a very crude, very basic, non-evidence-based measure, but it's the best I have from personal experience in the cath lab. So at that point, I say, what sky stage? I mentally sky stage. And if there's C, D, and E, that's very obvious. But it's sky stage B that worries me the most. Because these are the patients, you open the artery, then they start this negative spiral of myocardial ischemia, reperfusion injury, no reflow, and then you don't know what to do with them. So anywhere B through D, I stop, I get I upsize my access and get usually a mechanical circulatory support device in, which may involve either the impeller, which is my device of choice, or the balloon pump if it's a plus minus case, or rarely via ECMO if they're crashing. But you should have the ability to candidate for any of these devices. And the minute I see shock, my device always goes in before PCI, because I think Dr. Moeller, who presented the trial, had a beautiful statement, which I could not have said it better. He said, in the short run, in the next hour, the ventricular function is going to save the patient's life. In the long run, 10 years out, the open artery is going to save the patient's life. And to me, that's a very important guiding principle of how we care for shock patients.
Yeah, I know that these are excellent practical bedside teaching points. So thank you for going over your algorithm as to how you risk stratify these patients. And make the decision upfront for deciding whether or not to go ahead and put the impeller device in before doing the primary PCI. Now let's go over the results, because you know the results are you know, fascinating and something we need to discuss as well.
Absolutely. So their primary endpoint was a 6-month composite endpoint. So unlike other, 6 months or 180 days, unlike other studies that have largely looked at 30-day outcomes, they looked at all-cause mortality at 6 months for impeller CP was a standard of, plus standard of care was a standard of care alone. So the impeller CP arm had 45.8% mortality as against 58.5% in the standard of care arm. Again, clearly nearly half, one in two patients don't make it out alive at 6 months. Hazard ratio of 0.74 and a confidence interval of 0.55 to 0.99 and a significant p-value of 0.04. Then they looked at secondary outcomes. The secondary outcomes was composite at 6 months of escalation to additional MCS, either short or long-term, cardiac transplantation or death of any death from any cause was also positive with a hazard ratio of 0.72, 52.5% to 63.6%. They did have higher composite or worse safety endpoints with more with combination of severe bleeding, limb ischemia, hemolysis, device failure, and worsening AR. 24% versus 6% hazard ratio of 4.74. So sepsis, renal replacement therapy, need for renal replacement therapy, and limb ischemia were all higher in the impeller arm. So in context, what this tells you is, despite having higher complications in the impeller CP arm, these patients still had a durable mortality benefit that lasted for the first 6 months, and the curves continue to diverge after the first 30 days. So other trials have looked at 30 days. These trials looked longer. While clinically, these patients often declare themselves in the first 24 to 48 hours, good high-quality healthcare delivery for these patients with or without mechanical circulatory support has durable long-standing results for up to 6 months. And I do want to note that the upper bounds of the confidence interval for the primary outcome was 0.99, so almost approaching unity, which would mean that that would make the p-value insignificant, but it did not in this case. So if we choose to hang our hat on that hazard ratio upper bounds crossing one, and p-value of less than 0.05, this trial is strictly positive. Now, if you look at the fact that these patients had higher complications, if we got better at complication mitigation, management, recognition, treatment, we could theoretically have an even more pronounced improvement in outcomes And that would make the trial even more strongly positive. So the fact that they had an outcome benefit despite the complications is an important finding to recognize.
Yeah, Saras, thanks for going over the results with us. First of all, I think this is the, congratulations are in order here because this is the first trial across the spectrum of all shock trials, whether you consider IABP shock or ECLS shock, I'm talking in the mechanical circulatory support devices space. This is the first trial in years which has shown a mortality benefit. Now, the critics of the trial will say, it took 10 years, you have 360 patients, your p-value is 0.04, so barely made it. And as you said, the confidence interval is not straddling one for the hazard ratio. So, it strictly is a positive trial. Despite the adverse event rate, the number needed to treat is 8. The number needed to harm, if you consider, the adverse events which you mentioned, sepsis, need for renal replacement, and limb ischemia was 6. How would you respond to that critic, to that comment from the critic? For a device like this, what would you say? What would you have to say to the critics of the trial?
Yeah, see, the umbrella is a very polarizing device. I'll be honest with you. I think as an interventional and a critical care cardiologist, I've seen these patients do well and do poorly on both sides of the spectrum. So it's not a very straightforward thing. As an Achilles heel of many of the shock trials, as you recognize, is that these patients get tremendous care in the cardiac cath lab. They get tremendous treatment. They get lots of attention. They get all these, close monitoring with multiple personnel, and they go to the cardiac ICU. And then at that point, they say best protocols and standard of care or judgment, which essentially could mean anything. And so in the ICU, a cardinal principle is prevention of iatrogenic harm, recognition, early recognition of theoretical complications, and aggressive salvage or preventing complications from getting worse and snowballing and coming to a point of no return. And so this early recognition and the ability to detect and treat complications is critical in these patients. No single device, no single diagnostic tool, no single therapeutic tool acts in isolation in cardiogenic shock patients. It's a team sport with or without a cardiogenic shock team. You need to have protocols, you need to have policies in place, how you treat these patients, what to do, an algorithmic approach to these patients. And that is what saves lives. It is the multi-specialty expertise, involvement of best practices, and then codifying that so that can then be applied by whoever is staffing the CCU on a given day, independent of personal preferences and variations in practice. And I think subsequent trials, which are coming, including RECOVER-4, I think their ability to protocolize shock care in the CCU and beyond is going to be critical to showing an improvement in outcomes.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I think systems of care is what is required. And I think centered around the institution of device therapy here, which, now we have a positive trial. I think my personal take on this, and, I was discussing this with one of the representatives from Abiomed, the manufacturers of the device that is in question here, is that, I think two key things from my perspective. One is reduction in the sheath size for the device, which you will reduce limb ischemia and access site complications and bleeding. And then the other aspect of this, will be, again, standardized protocols to guide operators to consider antegrade perfusion. And I sort of wanted to discuss this with you, Saras. In your practice, do you do it ubiquitously across all your cases in which you put the device in, or how do you make the determination of establishing antegrade perfusion in these cases?
That's a great question. If it's via ECMO, I invariably almost always put in antegrade perfusion catheters. My traditional practice has been to put a 6-inch braided sheet in the SFA in the antegrade direction, connected with a male-to-male connector to either the arterial limb of the ECMO or to the contralateral common femoral in case of impella. In case of impella, I am less ad hoc or upfront with my antegrade sheet. It's more ad hoc. What I do is typically, and this is advocated by Abiomed too, as you said, is two things. One is never leave the peel away sheath in, because that obviously is a big nidus for vascular complications. It may break, does break within common femorals and iliacs. And so always retract the peel away sheath, break it up, take it off, and then put in your repositioning sheath. I think there are many good principles with repositioning sheath. You hub it all the way till the white and blue transition point. You put a stack of gauze under it, kind of may have it go in at that, you know, 30 to 45 degrees angle so that it's not pulled down flush against the skin, tenting up the artery. And then nowadays, the repo sheath comes with a sidearm. So what I do is I do two things. I take a standard O35J and put it in the repo sheath all the way to the aortic root and take a fluoro off or a cine off the aortic root with the wire in there and the impeller. So it tells you the depth of the impeller right away. So you know exactly how deep your impeller is, if the joint is at the space, at the level of the aortic valve, and if you're good. And then I pull the J wire out, I take a contrast syringe, half and half, and then I inject it under fluoro or cine. And then you look at distal perfusion. Obviously, by the time you're done with the case, your hemodynamics have stabilized, hopefully, your impeller level settings are stable, and your vasoactive medications are stable, which is what caused vasoconstriction. So at that point, if you take an injection and you don't see distal outflow, you know that if this patient goes to the CCU and they worsen, they will go up on your drips. The distal outflow will only get worse. At that point, I go ahead and put in an antegrade perfusion sheet below the repositioning sheet. If not, I send them to the CCU. We have a protocol where we check Dopplers at frequent intervals, making sure that there's posterior tibial and dorsalis pedis or popliteal are frequently checked and are documented. And if there is any compromise, we always, you know, start looking at hemolytic markers, start looking at lactate, start looking at CKs and making sure there's no acute compartment and things like that. So with impeller, I'm less aggressive with putting all patients with a distal limb perfusion catheter, but my threshold's very low.
Yeah, excellent. Let's talk about relief HF. Context here for the listenership will be of advantage. You know, what was the context, the hypothesis, and what the trial wanted to achieve here?
Yeah. Relief HF is a very interesting trial. It's a placebo-controlled procedure, placebo-controlled. So there was a sham procedure, randomized controlled trial that was conducted across North America, Europe, Israel, Australia, and New Zealand. So largely represented across the globe. 508 patients with heart failure, both with reduced and preserved ejection fraction, were randomized to an atrial shunt with a Ventura interatrial shunt device versus standard of care. So the pathobiology or the presumption is that patients with heart failure often have elevated left atrial filling pressures. These are often reflected into the pulmonary vascular tree with minimal exertion, causing exercise intolerance, potentially causing them pulmonary edema, diuretic refractoriness, and there is no out because over time the pulmonary vascular tree remodels and then they develop pulmonary hypertension. And at that point, it becomes really difficult to treat these patients because now they have more than one reason to be dyspneic amongst other things. So the hypothesis is that if you could offload the left atrial filling high filling pressures into the right atrium through a iatrogenic interatrial shunt, then these patients will start to feel better by virtue of offloading this and taking it down the right system. So their primary outcome was a hierarchical composite outcome of death from any cause, heart transplant, LVAD, heart failure hospitalizations, worsening heart failure events, change in quality of life as measured by KCCQ, which is the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire. They used more commonly being used technique called the win ratio, where total wins versus total losses are counted and not all endpoints are equally important. There is a priority list of most important endpoint to least important endpoint, but at the same time, by making a composite endpoint, you have the ability to decrease your sample size and increase your N for outcomes. And so that was a primary hypothesis in the trial design. I'll wait to see what comments you have before I talk about the results.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, you know, neat concept here. You're sort of trying to relieve, like you said, elevated left atrial pressure, which is a common finding in patients across the spectrum of all heart failure phenotypes, whether it's heart failure with preserved ejection fraction or heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. I think the one aspect of the concept behind the procedure which fascinates me is, you know, at least this is, I mean, I used to read atrial septostomy as sort of like a salvage procedure in patients with acute decompensated heart failure to relieve left atrial pressure. So I do think it sort of borrows itself from that philosophy of atrial septostomy, where you're trying to actually create an iatrogenic atrial septal defect. And in the same vein, there is this syndrome, right? Luton-Buckner syndrome. It's congenital atrial septal defect, which is complicated by mitral stenosis. But the concept is the same here, right? I sort of wanted to get that into the discussion to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly, the concept behind the device.
Correct. You're absolutely spot on. That's exactly the proposed mechanism. It's interesting how the results have panned out. So we'll talk about that, and I'd be curious for your thoughts, because I'm not a structural operator. So I'd be curious for your thoughts as a structural operator and as somebody who is an avid consumer of literature in that space. So their primary outcome was a win ratio with a composite of all the outcomes we talked about. They also looked at safety and looked at all cardiovascular events in the shunt group versus the non-shunt group. So for their primary outcomes, they had an unweighted win ratio of 0.89 with a confidence interval of 0.72 to 1.09. So crossing unity and therefore not significant. And the win ratio also for the weighted for the interim analysis was 0.86 with a confidence interval of 0.61 to 1.22 and a p-value of 0.20. Their safety outcomes was the risk of all cardiovascular events was 219 among the 114 patients in the shunt group and 222 in the 108 patients in the placebo group with a relative risk ratio of 1.00. So absolutely on one with a p-value of nearly 0.96. What's interesting though is they had a pre-specified subgroup analysis. So at this point in totality, the trial is largely neutral. They had comparable efficacy and safety outcomes, which essentially says it's no worse to use this device, but it's no better. But in the subgroup, this is where it gets interesting. When they split patients by those with heart failure with reduced versus preserved ejection fraction, they used a cutoff of 40% to define this. So, and they said that the unweighted win ratio in reduced ejection fraction was 1.21. The annualized event rates in patients with the shunt and the placebo groups were 49 versus 88%. So a risk ratio of 0.55 and a p-value that is highly significant in HFrEF, whereas in HFpEF, their event rates were 60.2 versus 35.9. So the relative risk ratio of 1.68. So strongly opposite of HFpEF or HFrEF. So fundamentally, what this tells you is that HFpEF and HFrEF are absolutely two different pathologies. They have nothing in common except for the fact that these patients have congestion either intracardiac or throughout their non-cardiac vascular beds. But fundamentally, they're different pathologies, they're different populations, they have different comorbidities. There was a significant placebo effect. They were decreased. There were improved outcomes in both the sham arm and in the device arm. So there's definitely a signal towards improvement due to placebo effects. But after that, there was a signal towards significant improvement in hard outcomes in HFrEF, whereas a signal towards harm in HFpEF, which is an interesting concept. There are many postulations. So this was discussed extensively within my heart failure colleagues and their communities. But essentially, my learning has been that these patients are significantly different from the trial population of, say, Reduce Lab 2, which was another trial looking using a different device, but looking at similar concepts. But ultimately, it all hinges on the fact that how much pulmonary vascular remodeling have they had, and how much of that is affected by the higher flows that the pulmonary bed is going to see by virtue of this left-to-right new shunt that has been created. So the overall pulmonary vascular resistance is 2.1 Woods unit in this population, as against in Reduce Lab 2, where those who respondents versus non-responders, the cutoff was 1.7 Wood's unit. So the more adverse remodeling there is in your pulmonary vascular bed, the less likely that these patients will be successful with the left to right shunt, which makes a lot of sense. And then there's also this concept of things in HFrEF not working in HFrEF. So we have to be thoughtful. Should we actually have lumped these two populations together, or should we dedicate trials to one population versus the other? And understand that the bang for the buck in patients with HFpEF probably lies in addressing more of their comorbidities, such as atrial fibrillation, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, other things that contribute to HFpEF, rather than a primary cardiac target for intervention.
Yeah, you know, interesting. To your comment on this being a procedure from a safety perspective, I think it's relatively straightforward. It's an interatrial septal device. The orifice is 5 millimeters. I think it can expand to 6 millimeters. And it does that because of the discs, which are on either side of the septum, which facilitate a venturi effect. And by facilitating venturi effect, it sort of expands the orifice at the septum itself. And then I think to your other comment on pulmonary vascular resistance, which is a measure I report ubiquitously in my right heart catheterization reports, because I think it definitely pulmonologist who's referring you these patients. I think with the mean ratio, like you commented, of a little over 2, but less than 3 Wood units, is suggestive or indicative of isolated postcapillary pulmonary hypertension. What that means is that this is all being driven by elevated left ventricular end diastolic pressure, which is sort of the final common pathway in both or across the spectrum of all heart failure phenotypes. But again, I think it's sort of very interesting, eye-opening, sort of needs more investigation to understand why the outcome or the win ratio, like you said, was different in the HFrEF or heart failure with reduced ejection fraction subgroup compared with the heart failure with preserved ejection fraction subgroup. I think the device maybe is not ready for prime time just yet. This is how I read into this. And certainly, I'm sure there's going to be more investigation looking at that pre-specified subgroup analysis and then cost effect analysis. Again, sort of a programmatic approach needs to be determined if this device has to percolate clinical practice. That's how I see it. I don't know. What do you think about that synopsis, Saras?
100%. I think as interventionalists, we should never underplay the risk of any invasive procedure. And the data need to absolutely convince us that this does offer something significantly over and above what medical therapy and lifestyle interventions can offer. So I 100% agree with you. I think it needs a little more nuance, a little more finesse, understanding the amounts of guideline. So importantly, this trial has not been published, as you know. It's only been presented. So it'd be important to look at the final publication when it does come out to understand how much the extent of guideline-directed medical therapy they were on, were they maxed out on their doses, where were they along their LVEF spectrums, what were their big picture plans. Was this, like you said earlier in this conversation, was this used as a palliation, or was this a step towards getting them through to a VAD transplant procedure in the near future? Things like that. So I think there is more to this than just yes or no. I think heart failure is far more complex than many things we do in our practice. And I think this needs the appropriate respect and additional analyses.
Exactly. So, excellent. So, Saras, moving on, from cardiogenic shock, heart failure to now preventing our patients to go into heart failure. And that is the question on revascularizing or stenting lesions which are not obstructive, as we define obstructive in the common interventional vernacular. However, on angiographic findings or on intracoronary imaging findings, the operating interventionalist determines that this constitutes vulnerable plaque. you know, which could be a vulnerable plaque rupture, plaque erosion, or a calcified nodule. So vulnerable plaque, non-obstructive disease, in the setting of an acute coronary syndrome, I take it, or just vulnerable plaque, and what you do with that. I'm talking about prevent. So why don't you tell the listenership about the inclusion criteria and what the investigators found, and then we can sort of delve into our own practice patterns and, you know, what we've encountered in our own respective practices.
Yeah, no, this is a phenomenal trial for interventional cardiology, kind of hitting the nail on the head of the holy grail of interventional cardiology, which is really preventative cardiology. So this was a multi-center open label trial. So it was between 2015 and 2021 at 15 centers, largely in the East and in New Zealand. So Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and then New Zealand. With the population of which is slightly different from what you or I may see in our daily practice. So at about 1,606 patients, 73% men, who presented either to angiography, either for a stable ischemic heart disease or acute coronary syndrome. So in the former cohort, they may have gone significant non-invasive testing before they presented on the cath lab table. So they've had contact with cardiovascular services for a while. And then they looked at these patients, and then they said, which of these patients have plaque that does not meet obstructive criteria, which is either greater than 70% obstruction on angiography or FFR greater than or less than 0.8. So those were excluded. So only those were not, only those plaque or those lesions that were not either physiologically or anatomically obstructive were included. And then they did intracoronary imaging on these plaque. The intracoronary imaging was used to define vulnerability. So vulnerability was defined as an MLA of less than 4 square millimeters on IVUS or OCT, a plaque burden of more than 70% by IVUS, not necessarily on angiography, or if you did NIRS, which is near infrared spectroscopy, looking at a lipid-rich plaque with a maximum lipid core burden of 4 millimeters on pullback, or a thin cap fibroatheroma as defined by IVUS or OCT. So the reason this is important is because, as you know, Ankur, it's not the stable, calcified, thick-capped plaque that actually causes a STEMI. Often it is these thin-capped fibroatheromas, vulnerable plaques that are prone to plaque rupture and then thrombosis and then acute occlusion, which leads to a STEMI. So it's important that these be found and treated, because then theoretically, between that and lifestyle interventions and medical therapy, we could provide a significant change to the trajectory of these young or middle-aged patients who come in with STEMIs. Now, what they did is, so like I said, greater than 50% stenosis, negative FFR with these vulnerable plaque features, then they treated them with, or they randomized them to either standard of care, which at this time is medical therapy, or treat them with a mechanical therapy. Initially, this started as a trial of bioresorbable vascular scaffolds, BVS, and subsequently, because BVS fell out of favor over time, morphed into being a drug-eluting stent trial. So initially, it was bioresorbable scaffolds and then drug-eluting stents. They obviously excluded a good population of the patients that were confounded by other things like bypass graft patients, if they were previously stented in that target lesion, greater than 2 target lesions in the same vessel, heavily calcified or angulated lesions that would need a lot of preparation prior to deployment of the device, or bifurcation lesions that dedicatedly require 2-stent strategy. Their primary endpoint at 2 years was a composite of death from cardiovascular causes, target vessel MI, ischemia-driven target vessel revascularization, or hospitalization for unstable or progressive angina. And in these patients, those who received a PCI of the vulnerable plaque with optimal medical therapy, their rate was 0.4% at 2 years as compared to 3.4% in the optimal medical therapy arm alone, with a very strongly positive hazard ratio of 0.11 and a confidence interval of 0.03 to 0.36. These results held durability at 2 years, at 5 years, at 7 years, and longest term follow-up. Maximum follow-up was 7.9 years. So these consistently held positivity at that time. Their deaths were very few, as you may expect from a trial with stable ischemic heart disease, given the excellent medical therapy that we've been using. So I'll stop here and ask you for your impressions first. I'll be happy to fill in with mine.
Yes. So, you know, very well done trial. Flips interventional cardiology on its head, in my opinion, sort of becomes preventive interventional cardiology, like you eloquently mentioned at the beginning of the discussion of this particular trial. I think, I don't use spectroscopy in clinical practice. I never have. I have used OCT. I mostly use intravascular ultrasound. And there is chromatography on intravascular ultrasound, which sort of can give you a ballpark of vulnerability, you know, when determining plaque vulnerability, very similar to spectroscopy, although I know spectroscopy is considered the gold standard. And then, you know, I think OCT is really, really, in terms of its resolution and definition, can really differentiate thin cap fibrous atheroma from thick cap fibrous atheroma. And it's the thin cap fibrous atheroma which causes the problem and ruptures and or erodes and causes MIs. I think in terms of delineating that routinely in clinical practice, I think credit to the investigators, they did a phenomenal job. The follow-up is fantastic. This is a markedly positive trial. I mean, this is no holds barred, a markedly positive trial. The question is, are we ready for this to be prime time, you know, or do we want to see one more trial before we change our guidelines and we change how we deliver patient care? You know, before this was published, you know, I'll tell you what I was doing in my practice. And, you know, we've encountered this, you know, when we are doing, angiograms on referred patients, you know, whether it's, you know, stable ischemic heart disease with a recalcitrant angina on maximally tolerated anti-anginal therapy, or more so in the spectrum, for me at least, in the spectrum of acute coronary syndrome, whether it's unstable angina or whether it's non-ST elevation MI and there is troponin. And then you would see vulnerable plaque, you know, but it's non-obstructive. I've gone ahead and actually stented these patients just because I've been shy of leaving these lesions alone because they just look too risky on angiogram and on imaging. So I think it was very reassuring for me to see the results of this trial sort of reinforced what I've been doing in clinical practice, you know, when I've encountered such patients. Now, I haven't encountered them as commonly, or maybe we haven't looked as hard, you know, I don't know. But I distinctly remember at least two or three cases where I was in a dilemma. And then, you know, I went on to Twitter to see if others have encountered a similar scenario. There was discussion around this, you know, debates and polls around this. And, you know, I think when the trial came out and was presented at ACC, you know, it was very reassuring. It sort of made intuitive sense to me. That's my take on it. What do you think about this, Saras?
100%. I agree with all of that. I have a couple of caveats. One is, I think it's just a function of technology. I think we need better intravascular tools or easier intravascular tools to detect vulnerable plaques than we currently have. Like you said, IVUS has a good surrogate. OCT has reasonable methods of mechanisms of detection. But really, it's all largely NERS. And NERS, again, I have not used it in clinical practice. I've seen it used for research purposes. It's not ready for prime time. So I think as we get better at using these tools, the better we will get at detecting these plaques. And now on the strength of these data, we'll be less apprehensive about stenting them. That being said, I do agree with you. When I have an ACS patient, no clear culprit, I often put IVUS down these 50% lesions that look worse on IVUS than they do on angiography. And oftentimes you will see ruptured plaque, a calcific nodule with erosion, things like that, that are high-risk features. So I think that is the first thing, is just convincing our community as large to put down an intravascular imaging device down an artery that they're not convinced looks bad on angiography. If there's a high risk or clinical suspicion that this patient has had an ACS event or threatening to have an ACS event. So that's definitely the first thing. Is that I think we need to step up on the basics of intravascular imaging and push that forward before we start doing things like NERVs.
You made a great comment that we need to convince our community to put the intravascular ultrasounds down the vessel. Why do you think there is inertia? I mean, I've sort of always wondered. It's not difficult. I mean, it's just like putting a balloon in or putting a stent in. Why is there inertia? Because the uptake of intravascular imaging is abysmal. I mean, there have been papers published on this. I mean, you and I know this.
Yeah, it's complex. I'll be honest with you, it's complex. I don't think it's all just the oft-stated principles of time and reimbursement. The two reasons why people don't put down IVUS probes is because it takes too much time, which is not true. If you, for example, if I see a lesion and I know I'm going to fix it, I call out my guide, my wire, my initial predilatation balloon, and IVUS all at the same time. So by the time I get my guide up, I get my wire down, I predilate the lesion, the IVUS has been already assembled. So in theory, I have not lost any time. It's often when people think of IVUS as an afterthought, that's when you've had delays, and that's very frustrating. Again, a minute in the cath lab feels like an hour. I get it. But I think that if there's a mechanism and a method through which you can achieve it efficient and you have technical staff who are comfortable with the equipment and can assemble it in rapid speed, I don't think it's really a time issue. The other thing is reimbursement. Unfortunately, our reimbursements for IVUS is abysmal for the amount of positive outcome benefit that it has. Like it's on par with some of the major cardiovascular drugs like statins and ARBs, so things like that. I mean, it's a no-brainer that you should absolutely use it. The real challenge, I think, Ankur, is the same challenge. It's analogous to using a PA catheter in patients with shock. It's that a diagnostic tool never, ever saves lives. A diagnostic tool is only as good as a user who has the knowledge to interpret the information that comes out of the diagnostic tool. And that's where I think we struggle as a community is we have a gradient of interventional cardiologists who are trained over the eras from different schools of thought. It's a very young field. It's only 40, 45 years in the making. So the field has evolved rapidly and various centers practice things differently. So because there's no standardization of practice patterns, either over generations or over centers of the same generation, people are trained differently. And if you don't see it in training, if you don't use it, then the necessity to use it becomes very limited in practice. And after a point, there is this behavior where you believe your angiographic visualization or interpretation is as good as the IVUS because that's much easier and a much more convenient way to approach the situation rather than tell yourself that you're not good at this. You would rather take the time out, go out, learn the IVUS, get proctors, things like that, which is asking a huge commitment from an actively practicing interventional cardiologist with a busy practice.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think I've sort of struggled to wrap my head around as to why is there so much inertia behind using intravascular imaging. You know, coming to the second caveat, I don't know if you still remember it, but if you do, go ahead and discuss it before we move on to our next trial.
Of course. No. So one of the things I do want to say is that in this trial, less than 2% of patients were on PCSK9 inhibitors. As you know, PCSK9 inhibitors, high-intensity statins, strong dual antiplatelet therapy, those are the ones that are going to significantly change outcomes. So we don't fully know what the impact of these strong lipid-lowering agents or strong antiplatelet agents will be on these vulnerable plaques. Like they clearly decrease events. So if we were to find patients vulnerable to plaques, we were to identify a subset that would benefit from aggressive lipid-lowering, do we still need this modality? And I know we talked about this briefly already. So it's about using bioresorbable scaffolds versus drug-eluting stents. Because when you put drug-eluting stents into patients, you're trading one disease state for another disease state. Because now they have this metallic scaffold, which again, you are hoping that people have put down an IVUS, have sized it appropriately, they've prepared and predilated the lesion accordingly. They've done all it takes to make that stent successful. They've not landed in disease. They've taken appropriate diameters and appropriate lengths of stents. But if not, then you're going to deal with ISR. And then there's all the downstream effect from that. So unless it's tough for me to say that this trial is ready for prime time in a practice across the country where we are still struggling to get the basics of PCI and intravascular imaging right. And that is my challenge, is we are treating one disease state for another disease state. And maybe these patients are better off being treated with strong lipid lowering and antiplatelet agents and seeing what happens to them without a mechanical intervention.
Yeah, no, you know, great comments. And, you know, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your insight. I think the other big thing here with PCSK9 in particular, and, you know, other lipid lowering agents, which are high intensity or, you know, highly potent, is can they document plaque regression at a certain, you know, LDL level? I think that's going to be big prime time news. So, you know, I think it's a great segue for us to talk about reduce AMI, which talks about another drug class, you know, sort of class one indication in patients with acute myocardial infarction. This again, I mean, is sort of addressing the dogma, you know, head on. That is beta blocker use. I mean, beta blocker uses class one indication in patients with acute myocardial infarction for at least 3 years. And this trial studied the use of beta blockers post acute myocardial infarction in patients with preserved LV systolic function. So can you tell us about the results of this trial, Saras?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, this is a fantastic question. I think, like you said, it addresses a very basic question or a very long-held dogma in our practice. So this is a very pragmatic, open-label, registry-nested randomized control trial from the Swedheart investigators, which, as you know, is a fantastic database based out of Sweden, which has contributed a lot of important data initially as a registry and now has nested trials within this registry. So from September of 2017 to May of 2023, in centers across Sweden, Estonia, and New Zealand, they randomized 5,020 acute MI patients, underwent coronary angiography, with an LVEF of greater than 50%, so preserved LV function, to patients receiving metoprolol or bisoprolol cardioselective beta blockers to no beta blockers. The conventional teaching has been that all these patients need beta blockade to prevent ischemia, to prevent the adverse effects of negative remodeling, to prevent suppress any arrhythmias, not necessarily extra beats, but just arrhythmias. And then there is also conflicting literature from heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So these are not heart failure patients, but those preserved ejection fraction, that beta blockers may be harmful, may limit exercise capacity, may not serve the purpose of improving symptoms and quality of life, which is the whole point in patients with heart failure. And you and I have seen this in clinical practice or outpatient interactions where patients are exquisitely tired, sluggish, just listless after being on beta blockers. So what they did is their primary outcome was over a median follow-up of 3.5 years, composite outcome of death from any cause, new acute MI in those with beta blockers versus those without. And they had 7.9% events in the beta blocker group and 8.3% events in the non-beta blocker group with a hazard ratio of 0.96, an interval of 0.79 to 1.16, and a non-significant p-value. Their secondary outcomes were death from any cause, death from cardiovascular causes, MI, hospitalization for atrial fibrillation, and hospitalization for heart failure, all of which were comparable across the two groups. Their safety outcomes, which was bradycardia, second or third degree AV block, hypotension, syncope, implantation of a pacemaker, hospitalization for asthma, COPD, or stroke, were again all comparable between the two groups. So this is a tremendous study. So I'll wait for you to give me your thoughts, and then I'll share mine.
You know, Saras, this is not an acute MI, but I can tell you that in stable ischemic heart disease or chronic coronary syndromes or stable coronary disease, however you want to call it, and in patients with preserved LV systolic function, I would actually often be the first cardiologist to stop the beta blocker and tell them that we actually have no indication to be on a beta blocker. And then, you know, I obviously would start them on one post-MI, even if they had normal EF. And before this trial was announced as a late breaker in CRT, I was having discussion with Saurabh Dhani. I don't know if you know him. And I was telling him that, Saurabh, I surmise or I predict that this is going to be a negative trial, in that, you know, beta blockers will not show a mortality benefit in acute MI if the systolic function is preserved. And I was curious to see what the trial will show. And when it was negative, I was surprised, because, you know, I thought I'll be wrong, but I wasn't. And so I think, again, you know, when beta blockers were tested in the old Chinese trial with metoprolol, or I don't know if it was with metoprolol or with misoprolol, you know, I think it was not in the setting of the background medical therapy and advances in primary PCI and antiplatelet therapy that we have now. And so when our door to balloon times have significantly shortened, when there are systems in place, again, talking about systems for acute MI, you know, I think cardiogenic shock can imbibe those systems of care, where, you know, sort of the ball starts rolling right from the time point of ischemia, you know, where the patient is at home or in the emergency department and you've just diagnosed STEMI. I mean, everybody's on the clock and really wants to get the patient to the cath lab as soon as possible so that reperfusion can be established in a timely fashion. And what that has led to is that it has led to a significant decrease in total ischemia time. And you, the next day or the day or on the same day, you get the echocardiogram and the EF is preserved. You wonder, you know, what beta blockers will do here. Now, I know they're sympatholytic. But again, I think with all the advancements that we've made, you know, whether it's in pharmacology, whether it's in systems of care, whether it's in collaboration with, you know, emergency medical services in our communities and our hospital systems and ambulances, I think all has percolated to us delivering care so expeditiously and in such streamlined fashion that you now actually have a cornerstone drug which had a mortality benefit to not have a mortality benefit anymore. I mean, there's something to be said about how much we've invested as a field and as a community in decreasing our total ischemic time. That's my take on this.
That is tremendous. That's exactly what I was going to tell you or talk about with you. I 100% agree with you. Now, you have to put that into context with all the powerful DAPT therapies we have, the statins, the heart failure regimen. Again, these are not heart failure patients, but the other things like SGLT2 and stuff that have just revolutionized how we practice medicine. And also, I mean, again, this is a registry nested trial, so a small underpowered study, low event rates for something of this magnitude. Most of this event rates were single digit. And then there was about 18% crossover in one group and about 14% crossover in the other group. So it's not a perfect study. But I think my learnings from this study is that I would be more aggressive with beta blocker tapering for suspected beta blocker side effects. That I feel less worried. Again, this has to be contextualized to the United States setting where regulatory agencies are looking at beta blocker usage for acute MI patients as a quality metric. So I think a lot has to change from that standpoint for our community to get more comfortable with, you know, de-intensifying medical therapy in these patients who have well-preserved LV functions from all the reasons that you just highlighted earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I couldn't agree with you more. So moving on, Saracen, the final trial that you've picked for us to wrap up, you know, ACC for you is Orbita Cosmic. You know, again, a procedure, a device / procedure trial, and it had a sham procedure arm. So it has sort of become sine qua non of you know, Rasha Alami trials is their sham controlled procedure trial, which is fantastic for the field to answer tough questions. So Eric, if you can give context of why is this important? What was the hypothesis behind doing such a study, and what's the concept behind the procedure, and how can it benefit or help our patients, and then what the trial showed?
Yeah, no, great question. You're absolutely right. I think the space of interventional cardiology will benefit more from sham control trials to tease out the placebo effect, which we saw earlier with the atrial shunt study. So in this, the Orbiter Cosmic study uses a very interesting premise. So all our interventions to improve myocardial blood flow, decrease myocardial oxygen demand, improve, decrease anginal symptoms have all largely centered around intervening on the arterial side through the coronary arteries. What this trial surmises is that the venous side is equally important for improving blood flow to the myocardium, and that can be achieved by improving the back pressure or creating a deliberate outflow obstruction to the venous outflow from the myocardium, thereby improving, enhancing my blood circulation within the myocardial bed, or letting the myocardial bed soak in the blood longer so as to improve its oxygen extraction and therefore decrease its need for additional inflow from diseased arteries. So that's kind of how this study was designed. So what they did is, it is a randomized parallel blinded control trial with a sham control in this case, as this, like you said, the very definition of the Orbiter group and the studies that come out of their group, which are tremendous for our field. So at 6 hospitals in the United Kingdom, investigator initiated between May 2021 and June 2023. 51 patients, so very small trial compared to the other sample size that we're used to in cardiovascular medicine or interventional cardiology for that matter. 86% men, median age of 67, symptomatic CCS class 3 and class 4 angina, so really symptomatic patients. So they were to have ischemic or coronary artery disease, ischemia or coronary artery disease with no further medical or interventional therapeutic options. Now, as you know, as a practicing interventional cardiologist, that's a very subjective line. And then to randomize to either a coronary sinus reducer implant or a placebo procedure, as long as they have an acceptable RA pressure and as long as they have an acceptable coronary sinus anatomy. So for those of our listenership who are not familiar with the procedure, what this procedure entails is entering the right atrium through the internal jugular vein, typically, and using the right atrium as a conduit to go to the coronary sinus, which drains into the right atrium backwards, finding a location that is best suited to implant this device, essentially a flow reduction device. It's an hourglass-shaped device and essentially increases the pressure upstream to decrease the flow across it, therefore increase the back pressure into the myocardial bed. And it's typically deployed at the level of a coronary sinus valve so that the valve can straddle the device and keep it in place and prevent it from free mobile activity. So what they did is they also recorded daily anginal symptoms, which was one of their key outcomes through the app that they have that's patented to their group. And then they did exercise testing and cardiac MRI before, right after the procedure, and again at 6 months. So for results, the coronary sinus reducer in this case did not improve the primary endpoint of stress myocardial blood flow in ischemic segments. So within group differences of about 0.6 ml per minute per gram of myocardium, with a confidence interval of 0.09 to 0.20. So for the primary symptom improvement, so daily anginal episodes significantly improved in those with the coronary sinus reduction device, 40% more likely to report a reduction, odds ratio 1.4 and a probability of benefit of 99.4, with seen as early as 10 weeks and sustained up to 6 months. So over 6 months, if you average out these patients, those with patients with angina at baseline would be expected to have an 84.5% days free from angina. So almost 3 out of 6 months, they're angina free, compared to 71.5% with placebo. So essentially, it's a gain of about 15 days. So half a month of additional anginal relief, which is huge for these patients. No safety outcomes, issues, no MIs, no deaths. So generally safe, does not improve myocardial blood flow, but does improve anginal symptoms. I'll stop here and see what you have to say, and then I'll fill in with my thoughts.
Yeah, I think, Saras, you know, you and I see these patients. I mean, you know, off the top of my head, as you were explaining the study design and the patients which were enrolled for the study, I mean, off the top of my head, I have at least two names I've seen over the past couple of weeks. So we know that we have these patients in clinical practice. There is no room for improvement as far as medical therapy is concerned. I mean, their blood pressures are in the 110s over 70s or 80s. Their heart rates are in the 50s and 60s. They are on at least 3 antiangenals. They are completely revascularized, either surgically or percutaneously. And yet they have quality of life limiting, just disabling angina. I mean, I have a patient who uses a walker just to go from point A to point B because he's so limited by angina, and his coronaries are, completely revascularized. There is no instant restenosis. He's diligent about taking his medications. Each time I see him in the office, he's in the 110s to 70s, and his heart rate is actually 58, 59. And, I've sort of run out of options to help him. And so when this was presented, and, I have a friend at the Cleveland Clinic who's leading an investigation in the space with his device, and they enrolled patients in Canada. I think this could be a really exciting time for this patient subset, which both you and I see in our practice. And like you said, I mean, I think 15 days where they felt better is huge for them, is life changing for them. So again, I think opens up a lot of opportunities, not prime time, very promising, more needs to be determined and ascertained as to how we can introduce this procedure into our clinical practice for the benefit of our patients. That's my take on this. What do you think about this?
100%. I agree with you on all the points you just highlighted. I will say that the mechanisms of how this device helps these patients is not fully understood. It's kind of like the SGLT2 inhibitors of interventional cardiology. You just don't know how they act, but they do a great job, clearly. So the primary hypothesis of the Orbita Cosmic Group looking at redistribution of myocardial blood flow may not be it. Maybe there are other mechanisms. There is a subgroup that showed redistribution from the epicardium to the subendocardium, where the level of ischemia often is. So maybe we need to be more nuanced in our arguments with this device. And because this was a sham small trial, so sham controlled but still a small trial, I think we need larger trials. There is something similar looking at the same device in the American setting. It's called the Coursera trial. The Coursera 1 is a small trial, and then the Coursera 2 that's following up. The fundamental difference between Coursera and Orbita Cosmic is that Coursera actually is looking at exercise duration, and it's looking at patients who can do an exercise treadmill test initially and then do one after the second test after the device is implanted. The patients in Cosmic were so disabled that they probably couldn't even get onto a treadmill. So if it shows a benefit in that population, I'm curious to see how this will evolve in a slightly healthier extent of chronic stable angina population. Now, the other thing that you and I both know and that we should absolutely put it out for our listenership is that not everybody who is quote unquote medically and mechanically revascularized is really revascularized. There, unfortunately, I tried to look through the Orbita Cosmic data to see the extent of revascularization, and there was no data. So it's important to know that things like residual syntax score, CTOPCI, optimization of anti-anginal agents. Now, I mean, obviously, you're a really talented interventional cardiologist, you must have looked at all this in your patient when you said your blood pressure was 110s over 70s. That means you've maxed out his meds, you've put in revascularization attempts into every single vessel that is worthy of revascularization, you've tried to reduce the syntax score to the minimum. But again, that is not a standard of care for many people in practice. So I think that speaks to the importance of having a CHIP CTO operator who can take care of these patients to ensure that they get the best coronary result that they can with the right drugs that they can get. And then once you've exhausted your options, think about things like coronary sinus flow reducers that might help you additionally over and above all of this. So I think it's a work in progress. It's a very promising step in that direction, but it's not fully ready for prime time as of now.
Yeah, no, excellent discussion. That is Great points. Very thorough discussion. Thanks for picking these interesting studies and trials. What a great wrap up for the ACC. Any closing remarks do you have for our audience, our listenership, and for Parallax?
No, first of all, thank you to you, Ankur, and all your colleagues at Parallax for having me. I mean, this is my first time, and I couldn't be more excited to speak on the same virtual platform as you. For the listenership, all I want to say is, Ankur Kadla is a gem of a human being. I'm so glad that he's my friend, and I'm so glad he's doing this. Please do listen to the other episodes if you haven't already, because I've heard most of them, and they're just tremendous. So thank you for making me a part of the stellar lineup, and so glad we could connect on this platform.
Yeah, no, thank you, Sarasam. Well, thanks for your kindness, and thanks for the honorific words. I'll do my best to deserve them. And, you know, we'll for sure have you back to talk about other aspects of interventional cardiology in life. I know you have a lot to share, you know, having shared dinner with you at Shashank's place, you know, the guest of the episode. If you haven't listened to that one, that's episode 11110, just behind this episode. So if you haven't, just tune in and do send your feedback. We read your feedback diligently. We try to act on it. Do leave us comments on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spotify. And thanks again for joining us. Until other Monday, I'll see you then. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast produced by Radcliffe Cardiology in association with MakeADent.org. We aim to bring you a new angle of all things cardiology every second week. Review us on your favorite podcast app or send your comments or questions to podcast@radcliffe-group.com. To view the series, head to radcliffecardiology.com/podcasts/parallax. Thanks for listening.